previously broadcast program.
www.ckut.ca on the World Wide Web. News, interviews, and music featuring the voices of prisoners, their allies, and supporters. Tune into the Prison Radio Show on the fourth Friday of every month between 11 a.m. and noon, and every second Thursday of the month between 5 and 6 p.m. To get involved in Prison Radio, or if you need to access past programs, email prison@ckut.ca.
Rehabilitation.
I wonder if you know what the word means. Do you? It comes from the Latin root habilis. The definition is to invest again with dignity. You consider that part of your job, Harvey, to give a man back the dignity he once had? Your only interest is in how he behaves. You'll conform to our ideas of how you should behave.
I am not a number. I am a free man.
You were a number, you weren't a man, you want to be a human. I wasn't Jim Crow, and hell, I was number 586.
Why do you do a warder's job?
It's a good job. Responsible job. Officers like myself trying to...
Scum.
We're only enforcing the law.
The law. The law. When they hang my husband, is that just...
You're listening to the Prison Radio Show. My name is Yasmin, and I'll be your host for today. We would like to acknowledge that CKUT is located on unceded Haudenosaunee, Anishinaabeg, Abenaki, and Mohawk territories. The Kanyakehaga Nation is recognized as the custodian of the lands and waters on which we gather today. Jajaki, Montreal is historically known as a gathering place for many First Nations. Today, it is home to a diverse population of Indigenous and other peoples. We respect the continued connections with the past, present, and future in our ongoing relationships with Indigenous and other peoples within the Montreal community. On today's show, we feature an interview with prisoner rights and justice advocate Lindsay Jennings. She has a dynamic approach to the provision of support to prisoners and former prisoners who are striving towards their community integration goals. Her areas of interest include sharing knowledge with individuals who are incarcerated about harm reduction and overdose prevention, and facilitating life skills workshops with this marginalized population. She's a committed advocate who is passionate about bringing positive changes to those who are involved with the correctional and criminal justice systems by ensuring that substance abuse, mental health, and basic needs are addressed as immediately as possible once they have been admitted into custody and throughout their incarceration. She currently is a member of the Toronto Prisoners' Rights Project, and in the past she has worked with BASAN and with the John Howard Society of Toronto's Reintegration Center, which is an Etobicoke facility that helps recently released former inmates return to society. Also on today's show, we'll be featuring a short news update from a prisoner in Bordeaux. His sector has been locked down during the majority of the time since March of this year. The next piece is audio from a prisoner in Bordeaux, a provincial prison on the island of Montreal. In the piece, he talks about the situation in his sector where prisoners have been locked down the majority of the time since March 2021. He reads two responses from the administration to complaints he has made about lockdowns and the lack of access to air conditioning during the heat waves this summer.
Okay, so basically I have complaint sheets that I've made all the way to third level. Basically, I have responses and everything of pretty much the confinement that we had over here in Bordeaux. Basically, the director of the of Bordeaux said in French, en raison de contraintes oppressionnelles, il est possible que les heures de sortie de cellules soient modifiées. Et c'est que sans préavis. Ces décisions sont prises afin d'assurer la sécurité de l'ensemble de prémaîtres d'établissement. Ainsi, le 27 juin,
Il nous a été impossible de vous offrir du temps de sortir pour ces raisons. Soyez assurés que ces décisions font l'objet d'une évaluation au préalable et que les changements apportés au régime de vie des personnes incarcérées sont autorisés par la direction de l'établissement en tout temps. Votre plainte serait donc fondée mais sans qu'elle existe. So basically, she's saying that the reason why we're being locked up is because of security purposes, and it's not because of the manquement de personnel. It's like they're saying basically that the reason why the guards are not coming in and everything, we have to shut down everything because of security reasons. But there's other sectors that I've seen during that time where they're going outside, they're having fun outside and everything, and we're locked up in ourselves. And then there's another complaint that I made, which he says the sergeant over here, the CU over here, ends up saying, pour des raisons de manquement de personnel et de sécurité, votre secteur est effectivement demeuré dans la journée en confinant plus longtemps qu'habitude. Sachez que les régimes de vie sont sujets à changement sans préavis, mais sachez également que nous faisons toute notre possibilité afin d'éviter ce genre de situation. Basically, they're saying that the CU is basically saying that, yeah, there's missing people working and everything, and that the type of schedule that we have in our sector could change at any time without being advised. And basically, they're saying that they're trying their best to try getting away from the problem. But it still continues every single day. And also, I even have a complaint sheet that I made not too long ago concerning because of the heat waves that we had over here, and I was saying that we need like more fans in our sector, and the ventilation system in our sector is always closed. And he says basically that we have showers, we have fridges that we could put our drinks, and basically that we could make them ice water. There's always water in our sectors. There's water inside our cells, and there's showers that we could use to refresh ourselves. But like, he just doesn't. They don't care that we're suffering over here of like heat. And on top of that, like, while we're in our sector, on our cells, and we're locked up in our cells, they close the traps and they don't even let any cold air coming in into our sector or even in our cells. And then they're outside in like pure AC, and they're not even giving us a chance to being refreshed or anything like that. We don't even have chances of going in the showers half the times over the weekend. And I find it ridiculous that basically they do this, and it's going on for now like a couple of months, I would say, like about like 4 or 5 months now that it's been continuing.
Just to get it straight in terms of like the lineup of the things happening. So
yeah.
What you were saying in our last phone call was that since March 2021, you guys have been on pretty regular lockdowns. And during the week,
yeah,
what that looks like is that you're getting out of your cells maybe 2 hours a day, never for meals. And on the weekends, you're locked down like pretty much all the time. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah,
exactly.
Okay. And then, so these complaints you made, one was about that. And the response that you got was basically the warden being like, you know, this isn't happening because of any kind of work action on behalf of the staff. It's happening for security reasons, which is, you know, the vaguest thing that they can say to you guys.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Basically, you're using security reasons as a big thing, but, you know, there's other sectors and everything that are 10 times worse than us people that are arrested and everything. There's people that are even more security. Like, there's some ranges that you can't even get out without handcuffs and being tied up completely from head to toe. We're not like that, and we're like one of the nicest ranges in all of Bardo. and they treat us like we're the worst ones. And there's a lot of other sectors that are like outside of their cells most of the time over the weekend, and we're inside their cells. So it just makes no sense. They say that it's over security reasons and everything, but if it's over security reasons, why are you opening up other ranges? It's really ridiculous. Like yesterday, I didn't fight like physically, but I fought like verbally with the guards, because they're just treating us like pure animals, and they have just no remorse, any remorse at all. They're saying that, you know, this is the way it is, this is the way of security and everything, but it's really not because of security, because there's half of the times they say that when they're doing rounds around the cells and everything to make sure that there's no people that are hurt, no people that are hanging themselves, because it happens in prison that people hang themselves and they get hurt. I totally understand that, but over the weekends they say that they do it they're supposed to do around every hour to 30 minutes, but over the weekends it's like half the time they don't do a round in like the next like 3 hours. Like they don't, like, you know, like it's, they say it's security reasons, but it's really not. It's like they try reversing the word security into like the biggest thing, and they make it sound like it's so like urgent and so bad, but really it's not.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to 90.3 FM and Prison Radio Show, CKUT. That was a prisoner in Bordeaux, a prison on the island of Montreal. The Prison Radio Show accepts calls from prisoners wishing to spread the word about the situation inside. You can reach us by calling Collect at 514-876-3748. You can also reach us by regular phone at 438-337-8423, where you can leave a message for song requests, news updates, or shout-outs. Here's our interview with prisoner rights and justice advocate Lindsay Jennings. She's a committed advocate who is passionate about bringing positive changes to those who are involved with the correctional and criminal justice systems by ensuring that substance use, mental health, and basic needs are addressed as immediately as possible once they have been admitted into custody and throughout their incarceration. She is a member of the Toronto Prisoners' Rights Project, and in the past she has worked with PASAN and the John Howard Society of Toronto's Reintegration Center. I wanted to thank our guest for today's show, Lindsay, for coming on, and we're going to have some really great, powerful conversations today. And I just wanted to begin to give an opportunity to Lindsay to introduce himself. So what can you tell us about yourself, Lindsay, and the work that you've been doing around prison justice issues and similar things around abolition?
Yeah, thanks, Yasmin. So my name is Lindsay, and I'm a member of the Toronto Prisoners Rights Project. I think that I would also consider myself a prisoner rights advocate pretty heavily over the past about like 7-8 years here in Toronto. I think that one of the reasons why I'm in this work is just due to my own experience of being on the streets and being involved in like substance use, and then my survival decisions landed me in jail multiple times. Probably considered myself, as they call them, a frequent flyer. So I think that, you know, I am a white woman who grew up in a very privileged home, very sheltered home. And then when I found myself on the street and found myself in jail, it really kind of educated me very quickly about the realities of the world, and not just the little bubble I grew up in. And so I guess I couldn't believe how the systems would work and the injustices of the justice system. And so when I got out of jail my last time, that was pretty much my goal. My goal was to get back into this work, and, you know, and I wanted to be somebody that could go into the institutions and do work with folks inside that are currently incarcerated. And yeah, I mean, it's been about 12 years, but I feel like I finally just achieved those goals maybe like a year and a half, 2 years ago. So, I mean, it's been a long journey, but that's just kind of where I started and why I do this work.
And when you say that's amazing, that's so inspiring. Wow, like 12 years. And so when you say that you feel like you've, you know, met those goals or those objectives, and I think you said like a, you know, a year and a half ago or something like this, what signaled to you, or what was the sort of objective that you fulfilled and that you were aware, okay, I have succeeded at doing this?
So I think that there's still a part of me that I don't feel that. I don't feel that I have fully succeeded, but I believe that when I was hired on as a peer worker with John Howard Society, they had opened a reintegration center outside of the Toronto South. And when I was hired there, they told me that there was an opportunity to get clearance to go in and do programming. And I mean, I never thought I would get clearance. But they did give me clearance. And that was a big moment. Like, even just going back in and doing like the first program, it was pretty, it was weird walking down the hallway and you're walking beside an officer and you're not in handcuffs.
Yeah, you're on the other side of me. Wow.
Totally.
Wow. What was that like? Like, did it feel empowered? Like, did you feel empowered, or did you feel like, I don't know, do you feel like it sort of set you apart? Did you feel like alienated from the experience that you had, or do you feel like that was what empowered you to, like, because you experienced that and now you can, you know, work in a different way? Because, you know, maybe other people doing programming and stuff with people inside haven't actually experienced it themselves, and so it's limited, right? Because it's like, it's not their story. But and so when they're talking to people inside about, you know, whatever it is that they do in their programming, that's all good and fine, but at the end of the day, they don't really know what it's like, because they go home and they go, you know, they're not there. But for you, you did really know what it was like. So I find that very unique. I think you're right. I think, like, that's amazing that you did get clearance. It's awesome.
It is amazing. I mean, over the years after that, I moved on to a different job, where, again, I was granted clearance to a couple other institutions across Ontario. But that also came with this bump in the road. Because there's people. So I don't necessarily disclose, like, when I go in and do programming, I don't disclose to everybody that I've done time before and I'm here.
Right.
For that reason, right? Because I think that you also have to have boundaries about your personal information going inside. No matter who, no matter what side of the coin, being an officer or being somebody inside, always need to protect your personal information.
Right.
And so, you know, I was very comfortable in there. And that's very, that's also something that I'm very aware of even now when I go in, about how comfortable I am inside. I'm not scared of the folks inside. I'm not scared of sitting on range instead of being in a program room or asking officers to stand with me. I'm asking officers that they can go and sit back at their little table.
Which is not the norm for people doing programs.
It is not the norm. And I mean, I think I wonder sometimes, is that healthy? Is that not healthy?
That's really cool. I think that's amazing. I feel like, that's really a unique perspective that needs to be understood more. I feel like that's, it shows that there's a different way of, you know, like, a lot of the fears people have, like, you prove through your ability to tell them to, like, the guards to go away, and that, like, you're fine. You know, I would hope that.
I think it shows them something too. Like, there's so many officers that will be like, I can't believe how you keep them attentive, you know? And
interesting,
because you have to, I mean, you're not there preaching.
No.
About their so-called alleged wrongs or the things that they've allegedly done, or convicted of doing, right? Like that they're still, my hope in going in and running programs is to ignite some hope inside.
Right.
You know, one of the things I mentioned, like that you had asked, was what keeps you going inside? You know, my experience, I didn't have anything, nothing.
Wow.
I don't know what kept me going. And that's an honest answer, because my family had like disowned me and casted me aside. All my friends turned on me. I had a partner at the time, but my partner was also a drug dealer. So what was happening behind the wall, like in the community behind the walls of the prison, of the jails, I have no control of, right? So I really didn't have any support.
Wow.
I just kind of figured like, okay, I'm going to be in here. That means I am going to get out. That was really just a thought process, is that
right.
I will get out at some point.
That's it. Believing that, like, that's the hope, right? And you instilled it in yourself by just, like, looking around and being hopeful that that was, you know, the most likely outcome. That's amazing and very courageous, I think, to, like...
But you don't have a choice.
Well, some people might not...
You don't have the choice to leave and have those thoughts, you know, like,
right.
And it's this weird thing, like, you know, I struggle a lot with being present and staying present in the moment and not letting your thoughts like go crazy. But yet being in jail, you have to be present because you just have to get through the day.
Because there's nowhere else to go. Like, there's no way
you can't go anywhere else. There might be nothing else to do.
You can't go online and pretend, you know, that you're living some other life, or the way people are on Facebook or whatever they do. You know, like, there's no, yeah, you have to basically deal with everything. But I think that's the very part that I find so inspiring about what you just said, because a lot of times I think it's hard for to even have that, to even think about that. Not that they don't think it's possible to get out, but that's not what they're thinking about at the moment. You know, it's like probably very, I don't know, but like I can imagine it very overwhelming and very oppressive and very scary and, you know, alienating, right? Like, you don't, like you said, many people might not have, well, you didn't have contact with your family. And they had like sort of, like you said, cast you off. So it's not like, you felt like you had people rooting for you, or not your family, like rooting for you to get out. So that's amazing that you came to that from your own, like from your own being. And then that's, I think, what is very cool. I'm glad I asked that question, because I feel like that thread or having that helped you to like know that. And then you could just focus on whatever else was happening. So like the whole situation isn't bearing down on your ability to be able to, you know, do whatever it was else that you needed to do to like basically try to maintain, right? Like that's really beautiful actually. And when did
I spend a lot of time, like even during when I did my time, I read a lot. You know, I had a small group of people. Oh my, I can't even tell you. I mean, that's a lie. I have two books still, which some people may be listening, if they're listening and they have done time, I don't know if it's bad luck to be keeping the books that you had from prison. Like one of the rules was, is never leave jail without finishing the book that you're reading, because if you don't finish the book, you'll be coming back. Very superstitious. There's a lot of superstitions. Wow. Inside about certain things that you should not be doing. Wow. And so I actually have two books. One was just a poetry book, and then I think, I don't know, it was some other book. It was like 800 pages. I figured this would give me a lot of time to read a large book. So, but I can't, their library isn't the greatest. There's probably like, there was surprise some like Nancy Drew stuff. There was, if you were lucky to get a John Grisham book.
Wow.
Stephen King, probably. Like, it would also depend on the institution and the library that they had. It also depended on what level of security you were in. If you were in max, medium, or minimum, you'd have different privileges and different resources, access to different levels of books.
Oh, really?
Even canteen, I don't know what it's like in all the institutions, but like even what your canteen, which is like you're going to like the convenience store. on maximum, we weren't allowed to have pop. And so if you got classified to go to medium because your institutional record was okay or your charges weren't violent, then you would get sent up to medium. And one of the benefits of going to medium was that you could get pop on canteen. Wow.
I had no... Wow, this is like some next level... Thank you.
And that was 12 years ago. I have no idea.
Thank you for sharing that. Like, just with our listeners and with me, I feel like it's really shedding some light on just like the level of control over every single aspect of your life and how the judgment or like the whatever it is, their analysis of whatever they think you're doing or not doing or the situation or however they try to reason it out, that they make a judgment over what you can eat at that point. And I didn't know that the libraries had like you only had access to certain things based on your classification. Like, that's wow, that's blowing me away right now. That's who comes, like, and people sit around and decide these things. And
there's like a book approval list. Like, there's only a certain types of books that you can even order for people right now. And they've created a list of the only approved books that you can buy for people. So, I mean, even textbooks and stuff like that, you know, like even if we had all our old like college and university books and we could donate them to the jails, guys and girls would pick that stuff up and just read it because they're interested. And they also have this idea that education in school is not for them or will never be an opportunity for them, right? I think that, you know, there's also a lot of folks inside that have literacy issues, right? And no fault of their own.
No.
It's just the circumstances of the state of how they've grown up and the social determinants of health.
And it's a sign of the failure of the Canadian state also.
Of course.
You know, it's like that shouldn't be happening, but it is happening because of all these other things that are broken in our system, or that actually not were broken, but they're set up that way so that certain people have access to certain things and other people don't.
And I never, ever saw the world through that view that you just said, Yasmin. Like, again, white privileged household. I had education. I had the support. However, I think that there's a difference between like having family support and like conditional loving. This idea of unconditional love that we talk about, that's like what you need to offer and what you should receive. That was not my family. Yes, I had support and love, but it was really based on behavior. It was based on making the choices that really they think are right or wrong.
Right.
And no fault of my family. Like, I think that through years of therapy and soon to come, we can get through that stuff. However, I think that that's another thing about jail and the justice system, that it is conditional. And so when you live for decades in that cycle of things are conditional, the idea of having any sort of unconditional support and unconditional love really, really like kind of holds you in your recovery or holds you in your process back into society, whether it be your family, your PO, employers, bosses.
Right. That's, wow, that's so profound. So interesting how that, what you just said, like, so these systems that are put in place, you know, and the concepts, the conditional this and conditional, like how that really affects the psyche and affects, wow, that's, and what you believe is possible, right? Like, it like impacts that. And that's really, I'm really like moved to hear that. I feel like that's very interesting to see how from, you know, being out and having the the support, or like realizing that that's a thing, like unconditional support, how
yeah,
like, that's an actual thing. It's just like makes you, you know, reflects on what was happening or what was leading you to believe otherwise. And then connecting that with your family, because yeah, of course, I feel like all, like our parents are people too, or, you know, our families are like, everyone is sort of held hostage by whatever it is that we think we're supposed to be fulfilling in society, right? So when you're saying the unconditional love, it's like, if you're making the choices that they want you to make, then it's great and they'll support it. But the minute that you're doing something wrong, somehow then you're a failure and you're on your own, rather than
bad. You're bad. This idea of good and bad, like, even let's duality. Go back to, let's stop telling kids that they're good and bad.
Yeah, like no one's good or bad. There's good and bad things people do. Like there's things that have good impact on people, and there's things that have negative impacts on people, and there's some things that could probably have both, you know, in different ways.
And when you don't have, when you're in the middle of those decisions in life, you know,
Sorry, just cut out for a sec. When you're in the decisions, and what can you
when do? You're like in the middle of a decision, and the circumstances around your decision is survival, your decision is going to be very different based off the good or bad, and from the resources that you may have and that you don't have. You know, right. I think that when my parents dropped me off at a shelter, have never been a part of the streets ever. And my parents dropped me off at the shelter, I feel like that was their idea of tough love, that they, you know, it's going to scare her. And so she'll be able to like come back and realize that she needs to act better.
Right.
But what they didn't realize is that I had to survive. I had to eat. I needed to be able to find a place of my own. And unfortunately, I mean, decisions on the street aren't the best. It's not like Ontario Works or social assistance is any sort of helpful, you know, because if you're staying in the shelters, you get like $250 a month. If you want to get an apartment, they used to give you like $400. Maybe back then it might have been like $370 towards an apartment, right? Which you could, or a room, which you could barely get anyways.
Yeah. And they don't adjust it by the place that you're living. Because like in Toronto, that just seems so like blatantly, completely out of touch with the reality.
Well, it is now, even more now, when you get $700 for social assistance. And we know that bedrooms, couches, people renting out their living room for $1,200 a month. So like, you're just actually just, you're enticing people to get involved in things. Like, a lot of my charges were petty. A lot of my charges were shoplifting winter coats, clothes, food. Wow. That was the beginning of things, right? You wow. know, and then the drugs came in because, well, man, you're on the street. It's something, right? It's something to distract you and let you move through the rest of the world.
Right.
And you know, I really don't, I think even our programming, like when we have programs for guys that are inside, guys or girls inside for trafficking drugs, give them opportunities to make, to have jobs that will pay the equivalent of what you were making selling drugs, because that's the only way you're going to make a, build a bridge for folks, right? Is to be able to offer supports and things that are actually going to provide for themselves, for their families, for their situations.
Right.
They may be taking care of family members, their kids, grandparents. We have right. no idea what people's situations are.
Right. And that goes to the root of like understanding that and having, providing programming or like things, incentives or alternatives that take that into account would mean that the system would need to understand or embrace what brought them there in the first place. Right. Which is the lack of the ability to financially support a family, you know, with the way minimum wage jobs are and the conditions and all that. And so like, I feel like it's in these kinds of discussions about people when they get charged and, you know, brought into the system, it's all on them. Like it's like this blame on an individual, but really when we start to look at how they got there, like you said, for winter coats, for food, for things that like should be accessible and should like no one should have to worry about, that's how it begins. And rather than, you know, looking at it as a systemic failure and like, how can we prevent that from happening again, instead of all the blame is put on people individually, you know? And so the state or the system is never really held to account. It's the person, right? Like you said, the and everything. And so that's,
I think though, if you're poor though, like if you fall into the, like, I think that, you know, when we see counselors and government get charged with DUIs and have to come on and do their 20-second little, I'm sorry, I knew it was wrong, I'm gonna seek help, but they don't, but that's it.
That's, yeah, it's not fair.
Do you know what I mean? And so that, but then you have other people that will be arrested for possession of drugs and they're looking at years. But then the sentence doesn't stop. You get released and then you have to live with the record.
Right.
Which, right? I know. So the rich get to give their apology. The rich will apologize and their jobs aren't lost. Their families aren't taken away. They're not limited to progressing through jobs or getting jobs in the future. Right? You know, I mean, even when we look at our police, if there's a complaint or if you're getting charged with something, then they're put on suspension with pay. We have police that are sitting on the sunshine list for 12 years and they're not active. They're on suspension. Right? I didn't get paid with carrying my criminal record and getting fired from jobs and having being treated like a criminal when I was applying for jobs.
Right.
You know, nobody, OW, that was their answer. Well, just hop on OW. OW's programs didn't help me. They didn't support me with a record.
What's OW?
Social assistance, sorry. Ontario Works Welfare.
Ontario Works, okay. Right.
Their programs aren't set up to support you, you know? I picked up a program out of social assistance at a youth shelter as a recreation worker, doing sports and stuff with the kids, which I thought was great. They didn't ask me about my record at all. 3 weeks into the job, they found out I had a record. They fired me within 24 hours, and they escorted me off their property, and they told me that it was my fault that I was not honest with them. You know?
Wow.
And people are like, well, you shouldn't have signed the contract. You should have got a lawyer. But again, I'm poor.
Right.
I'm poor. I don't have money to go find a lawyer to fight my employment battles. You know, I also don't have time to go sit in community legal clinics for 8 hours a day with no guarantee of being seen.
Right.
I need to find a job and I need to pay my bills.
Right. Yeah, that's... Wow. Wow, there's so much, like, thank you for really fleshing some of this out, like, in real life terms. I feel like it's one thing to read reports or to, you know, get facts, but it's another thing right now, hearing, like, what you're saying really sort of broadens the scope or the idea of what it's actually like and, you know, how things play out, like, this whole issue about you should have been honest with them. But I don't know if that's not really a legal requirement, right?
But when you carry that record, mm-hmm. nothing that you can say in that moment feels appropriate. Feels like it's going to make any difference because you're being judged on a criminal record.
Right.
You're being judged that you are a bad person or you're not trustworthy, you know? And I didn't carry heavy charges. I
right.
can't imagine what it's like for people that are carrying heavy charges, gun charges, human trafficking charges, murder charges. Like, that stuff, I give a lot of credit for people. And I'm not asking people for sympathy, but just, like, taking a moment and trying to have some empathy or trying to, like, think about how it must feel for people's self-confidence, their self-esteem, their identity, their soul, their spirit, having to go through life always worrying about one question. Are you gonna pass a criminal record check?
Wow.
It's just one question. I know I had the schooling. I went back to school. I have the skills. I'm good. I have all the qualifications you want, but I'm not getting this job because of one thing. Over and over and over again.
Wow. This is the urgency. So we had a recent episode of Prison Radio Show. We interviewed someone with the John Howard Society, Safiya Hussein. Actually went to law school with her, and one of the things we discussed is the work that they're trying to do around this very issue, about the concept of like what used to be called pardons, you know, but like trying to move away, or like to try to transform or change the way we do things in Canada to sort of go. There's other examples that are more progressive in other places where, you know, the record is, no one has to apply for a pardon, right? And pay all this money that they don't have and try and get a lawyer. Like it puts the burden on the person who the system, you know, didn't really, like the burden shouldn't be on the person who had already, you know, spent time in prison, did what, you know, so-called did their time, to actually after that have to go and make sure that their record, you know, that record isn't still being used against them. It's like a never ending, I forget the term of it, but it was like, in order to make it so that the sentence, you're not, like exactly what you said, it's like you're constantly living in the like it's precarious because you never know, and often more times than not that will be used against you. So even though you did all the things you're supposed to do, it's like still a weight on you. So that's not really fair, because it kind of goes against the whole premise of the system. And like, oh, if you go do your time and then you're done, but you're not really done, because if the system's still judging you by that and putting you into a category and preventing you from actually reintegrating, then it doesn't work, right? So
the pardon process is like this whole other beast. I've been waiting. So I thought I was eligible for my pardon 5 years after. So 2010 was the last time I was in jail. So December of 2015 was supposed to be my 5-year eligibility period until I could apply for my pardon. And I went and I applied for my pardon, and the person came back and said that I had outstanding financial fees. Like restitution and fines. And I didn't even know that I had these. Like, it's so interesting, like with your getting your driver's license, you can't renew your driver's license without paying off your fees, right? Like, I just feel like somebody should have told me that I had fees. But again, I didn't have the money that I owed. And what I found out was that your eligibility doesn't start until all your fines and restitution are paid off. So now I've been waiting an extra 5 years. So now I've been waiting 10 years to get a pardon that I should have gotten in 5. But with what Safiya was saying is that the spent regime would be that it would be like an automatic certain amount of time, and then automatically within the system, your records would be sealed.
Right.
So I feel like mine should have been sealed long time ago, but right. The process, like, I think the process of finding pardons, you know, I always tell people, if you have this eligibility period, go to the courthouse, find out if you have any fines or restitutions. Like, judges used to give fines all the time, noise disturbance, the homeless in the parks, they would give them fines. Why are you giving homeless people fines? They have no money.
Right.
Right. And so if they wanted to get a pardon for all their petty survival crimes, they would still have to pay back all those fines that the judges gave them. And they probably don't even know they have them.
Wow.
So it's this cycle that, like, I'm not, honestly, at one point I was like, screw all of this. This is like, I can go back and sell drugs and make more money, be more financially stable than I am now. But it was around not having to look over my shoulder. I never wanted to go back to jail again. There was things that, like, you know, I wanted to be, have a happier, more safe life.
Right.
But it's not easy. It's still not easy. You know, even going through my pardon, like having to, I'm going to apply now to get my pardon, but even have to go through all that stuff, you know, relive all that stuff and to think about why you're actually arresting me and to think about those little moments. And then once again, try to trust this system that they're going to read my application and grant me this weird sense of freedom through a ceiling, which realistically anybody can access if they really wanted to. So it never really goes away.
Wow. And so now you're at the process where you're reapplying for that, or you have?
Yeah, I talked with some people like Sophia and some other people from Canadian Civil Liberties that also sit on that committee around the spent regime.
Right.
And one of the things is, you know, a lot of people, when they get involved in this stuff, they want to help and give back, right? As it sends to them. You know, a lot of people might get into social work, community work, wanting to do this. And so at one point I decided I wasn't going to get my pardon because anytime I got a vulnerable sector check, it would come up. I thought that all my charges would come up anyways.
Right.
It took 12 years for me to finally get a straight answer about what is disclosable on a sealed records check compared to not, you know, and this was feedback that I actually gave to Sophia and to other people about how important it is that if you have 8 different organizations and they all are running record suspension workshops, they need to be standard and answer the questions. I didn't know that people with, if you have gun charges, those are non-disclosable. So it would be okay for you to get your pardon. I didn't know that. You know, I don't have gun charges, but I know a lot of people in that situation that sometimes when you are carrying the record that you carry, like the offenses and the charges, I mean, even you have folks that maybe carrying sexual assault charges, like you just don't think that your life is, that any sort of quality of life is possible for you.
Wow.
You're just going to figure out some sort of life that gives you a little bit of basic needs, roof over your head, food in your fridge, can take care of your family if you have one, and to stay out of trouble. It's not necessarily about happiness.
Wow. Yeah, and with the fines, and like, so did you have to pay all of the fines that?
I did. And then my 5 years started.
And they never told you about them, and there's no procedure
ever.
When you're released.
And do you know how much money I spent on getting criminal record checks for school, for volunteering, for other jobs? And never once does a flag come back saying you owe money, but you want to keep taking my money.
Wow.
To get the record checks, to give me a big red X saying this person does not pass the criminal record check. You know, I think if they added up the amount of money I spent on police record checks, it would be more than what I owed in fines.
Wow. And do you have legal representation? Like, I just wonder, because
no.
To me, this seems like, you know, as a practicing lawyer, something that we deal with all the time is about notice. You know, when you're, you know, if you launch a lawsuit, there's this whole process where you have to serve the other side with the documents because they need notice and time to respond, right, to whatever, you know, if there's a lawsuit launched against them or, you know, in a government office or whoever it is that you're trying to, you know, have legal action against. There's always this concept of notice for everything so that it's, you know, fair. So that it's another person, the other party has time to respond. And this issue about the fact that you didn't even know that you had these fees to pay and that that was preventing you from, you know, doing, you know, sort of getting on with another step, and that that was not told to you, like that that information is not sort of given to everyone or like not made accessible or like people are not made aware of that, I find that really problematic because they should be giving notice of something if they're going to use that as a way, as a mechanism to then prevent you from doing other things. You need to fulfill that first. That needs to be told. So I'm not sure why, like, what the rules are around that, or, like, you know, if there's no regulation around that. It seems like a very big gaping hole, like many of them with the justice system, but, like, especially just in terms of law, like, you need to have notice and you need to be, you need to know what you have to do, right? Like, it's like a way of, I guess, keeping everyone in peril. I'm not sure what, yeah, that's interesting to me. I don't know. To me, I'm feeling like...
Me neither. I feel like I should be able to move forward. You know what I mean? Like,
it could be a massive class action, though, against the provincial and federal government for this, because if you've gone through this, think of how many other people, right, are also in the exact same position, and that the longer this maintains, like, it stays like that, it's like the government isn't being held to account. You know, you can't have it both ways and say someone owes you money, but don't tell them about it and then expect them to somehow magically know about it or use it as a way against them to be able to do
anything. Tell us about every other dollar that we owe the government.
right. That's a really good point, right? Like, when you owe money on your taxes and stuff, like, you're informed of that, right? So I find it really, yeah, I would like to look more into the history of this and, like, what it's like in other provinces. I wonder if there's the same kind of practice, and if this is like a system, like, you know, a basically unofficial mechanism to just keep people beholden to, like you said.
Of course, it's a way to keep people in that system, right? And I'm not going to lie to you, there's always, I mean, I've been pulled over by the police, obviously, in the past 12 years. But any police interaction, I still get nervous. I still get nervous that if they run my name, what comes up? I'd like to know what comes up on their little screen. But that fear is still there.
Right. Yeah, and people should have access to that. I find this very, like, very disturbing. Like, I feel like that information is about you. It's like a medical, like a record. You know what I mean? Like, that should be accessible to people. Like,
not accessible necessarily to us. It's accessible to Canadian Border Services, the FBI, the RCMP, the police.
Well, is it also accessible to anyone that would prospectively be hiring you?
So that's what the record suspension basically does. Well, that's what it says it does. That it seals your record so that employers, when they're running a basic criminal record check, it should come up as clear.
Okay.
Now, if you were getting a vulnerable sector check, I don't know what comes up. I don't know if it says these records have been sealed, which then still outs you.
Right.
That you have a record. It's just been that your pardon has been granted. And I think that even that question, like, on application forms, and it's like, have you ever been charged and not been granted a pardon? Like, even if you were granted a pardon, you're still outing yourself, and so at any point in time, some people may be like, oh, you were granted a pardon, that's so lovely, that means you fixed your life, you made some decisions, blah blah blah. Some other people would be like, it also, like, it comes down to money. It costs more to hire somebody that's not bondable on their insurance.
Right.
Than somebody that is bondable. And so, once again, like, you're just stuck in this. You may get the position, but are you being judged through that? And how does that, like, raise anxiety through interviews and how you're viewed within the organization or business? Do people tell your business? You know, like, is confidentiality real, that the only people that knows that you have a record is the employer, the boss, and you? Does it stay like that?
And that was an interview with prisoner rights and justice advocate Lindsay Jennings. Lindsay is a committed advocate who is passionate about bringing positive changes to those who are involved with correctional and criminal justice systems. Her areas of interest include sharing knowledge with individuals who are incarcerated about harm reduction and overdose prevention, and facilitating life skills workshops within this marginalized population. She works with Toronto Prisoners' Rights Project. In the past, she has worked with PASAN and the John Howard Society of Toronto's Reintegration Center, which is a trailblazing Etobicoke facility that helps recently released former inmates return to society. To listen to our whole interview, you can check out our podcast. Anywhere where you get your podcast, just look for Prison Radio Show. And you've been listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on cable, and www.ckut.ca. You can check out past episodes of the Prison Radio Show at prisonradioshow.wordpress.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at Prison Radio Show. Prison Radio Show, like I said, is now a podcast. Check out episodes of PRS Podcast on Libsyn or anywhere you get your podcasts. The next Prison Radio Show will air on Thursday, October 14th at 5 p.m. If you have any questions on anything that you've heard on today's show, or if you wish to be involved with the show, feel free to contact us at prison@ckut.ca. Formerly incarcerated people are encouraged to participate. Folks can also leave a message on our new listener comment line at 438-337-8423. If you are in prison, we encourage you to participate in the show in any way possible. Feel free to write to us at the Prison Radio Show or simply write PRS, care of CKUT, 3647 University Street, Montreal, Quebec, H3A2B3. Thank you for tuning into the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM. My name is Yasmin and I've been your host for today. Please stay tuned.
Sarah's excited to celebrate her birthday at a restaurant. She's thought about it all week. She invited her friends. She got a new dress. She went to the restaurant. She wasn't allowed in the restaurant. She had to put away her new dress. She couldn't see her friends. And she thought about it all week.
To make an appointment for your booster dose against COVID-19. Visit quebec.ca/COVID vaccine to follow the vaccination sequence plan for your area and book your appointment online. To continue protecting yourself against COVID-19 and its variants, get a booster dose and keep following distancing measures, wearing a mask, and washing your hands. The booster dose, the best way to stay protected longer.
A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
Afternoon, you're tuned to Butcher T's Noontime Cuts, hitting every Friday from noon to two, playing you a wide variety of music just to make your afternoon delight just right. So stay locked into CKT 90.3 FM.